ahead. I will speak about evaporation in general, and I'm one of these people who is interested in details. I'm not here to show that anything was wrong in the previous part, but I want to raise these issues and see if we can have some discussion about these subtleties. So some things that came up RT in this talk will be the truncation radius, or the king radius, or the king tidal truncation radius, whatever. And I will reserve RJ for the Jacobi radius, which is where the net forces of the cluster and the galaxy are equal, so it's at zero velocity surface. You can approximate that for the sphere. And then one term which will cause a lot of confusion is what is Roche-Loeb underfitting. So we've done some runs where we started the cluster by dividing the position of the stars by a certain fraction. So you take a king model and then you divide everything by two, and then RT is half RJ. Right, so we call that Roche-Loeb underfitting. But I think that is a really bad definition. And I think one option for now is that you could say it's RH or RJ smaller than this value. And this value is because if you take king profiles and you construct a model, you have certain flexibility in how large or small you can make this RH or RJ. And 0.1 is kind of the minimum, which is for a certain value now. Right, so
they're saying there's no reasonable king concentration parameter that would give you RH over RJ less than that for a tidally truncated model.
In the three-dimensional 66 models. So Holger pointed out to me yesterday that the observed king profile actually allows for much larger spreads, much smaller ratios RH over RJ, but they're basically directly going into core collapse if you would construct something like that initially dynamically, right? So we want to have something in the runs which starts compact. And if I say compact, I'm always referring to this ratio. Right? So I'm not going to say that this really matters, that if you initially have RT smaller than RJ, I don't think that's a big deal. It's the RH over RJ that is kind of the topic. So some of the assumptions, like Mike did, I'll keep it simple in the sense that I'll leave out the escape time, which has been shown to give some different scaling into how mass evolves, but I'll keep it to zero because then all the formulas are simple. And I'll keep the relaxation time simply mass to the half RH to the 3/2. So I neglect Coulomb logarithm and the mean mass of the stars just to give it some. And just to be very clear, I do not care about what the initial mass function is of global clusters. So I'm not trying to prove a point that it was this or was that. I just want to see what is the evaporation rate as a function of density. And what kind of index do we have to stick in the density to make it work and match my simulations? So it's basically the same thing. So the mass loss rate is a certain fraction that we lose in a relaxation time scale. And this idea is old. This comes from, I forgot to put this one in my slides in the conference. So I became 4300. I was not up to date before 1940. But I actually mentioned it in the paper. So. And then what you can do, if you connect the RH in the relaxation time scale equation that we saw before to the tidal radius, which is most of the people that do simulations, they do that. Several reasons for that. First of all, it eliminates a parameter, namely how much do you underfill that Roche-Loeb, or how much do you divide RT to get the ratio RT over RJ. So that's always nasty, you already have too many parameters in most simulations. And the other reason is that if you make RH very small, it just, in dynamical Emory times, will take very long to evolve to a hollow plane. Right, so most of the people start simulations connecting RH to RJ, so the RT is the same as the RJ initially, limits the parameter and reduces the calculation time.
You've lost me already. Are you going to assume that RH over RJ is constant?
No, this is something you could do, like you could assume it. That is an assumption. If you assume that, so RH, you link it to RJ, and then you plug that in this formula, you get that the mass loss rate scales with the Jacobi density to the half.
Well, it scales with rho to the 1/2, where rho is whatever you decide to plug in.
Okay. I will come back why this is important.
Because we saw a diagram that Holger made yesterday of observed RH over calculated RJ, and it's all over the place, so it's certainly not a good assumption to take that.
No, I agree. That's why we have to look into that.
Or to be some universal number.
Yeah, no, this is not the end of the talk. I'm just saying, some people would like that to be, but it's not. This is just what most of the people do with their simulations. If, whether it be Fokker Planck or MOD, people link RXRJ, they choose a King profile that gives you that ratio, right? It's a constant, and you can put this cluster in different positions in the galaxy, but that ratio then is constant for all the simulations. Later I will show why it is. Okay, what does this rho j mean? So if you rho j into the half, basically scales with the density within the orbit of the cluster, right? Just for circular orbit, the density within the Jacobi radius in the isothermal sphere is 2 times the density within the orbit of the galaxy. So it's something the square root of the mass within the orbit, in the galactic center position, divided by the galactic center position cubed, which is the same as V over R, is something like the angular frequency, omega. So I'll do most of it in omega, but this is just, it's all the same. So some people do it like this, other people call it like that, and we did it like that. But it's the same.
This is, we all agree this is correct?
Yes.
Straightforward. But there is RG, which is not.
Okay, so this I think is standard. Many people have done this. Here you see an abstract of the paper of Leon Ostrager, who showed that basically they call it a T, it's computing, but they mean J. Let's be sure. Okay, now if you then plug this into, if you want to get the dissolution time, you can do it like this. You say that dissolution time is something like mass divided by massless rate. And then using that expression for m dot, you get something like this. So these are three equivalent equations. There's basically one parameter, which is the cluster, and then one parameter, which is the galaxy. So I already make a slight distinction of what Mike just did, because I say that this second parameter is dependent by dependent on the galaxy only, right? Because it's the density within the orbit.
Well, I'm just saying I use the same. I know there is no difference.
But you just said you don't want to hear about the orbit. So that's the orbit is in that RG. If you are willing to take a density without saying anything about the orbits, you are not doing this.
Well, I'm just, the orbit determines rho j, but if I could, someone could tell me rho j, I wouldn't care what orbit it came from. That's all I'm saying.
Right.
And in order to have no random gradient, you need to have the same RG for all the clusters, in order to have this, on average, the same rho j, which will give you no random gradient. So.
Well, no, I don't agree.
No, I think so, yeah.
But just, this is all rewriting things in many different ways with different variables.
No, so far. I'm trying to get everybody together, so far I think everybody
can possibly be any disagreement.
No, it will come later. Or maybe not, it would be great if we all this is it, I'm happy, I don't.
But again, it's all because you are assuming that the correct rho that gives you the n dot is rho j, versus Mike in his simple
equation
was using rho h.
It's starting from different sides towards the same point.
They're only compatible if in fact it turns out that rho h is some universal constant times rho j.
No, let me say this very, very clearly. The correct rho to use in anybody's approach, the best rho to use, is the rho j. And a good approximation to that might be the rho t. And that's probably a better approximation, theoretically, than rho h. So why am I using rho h? I'm using rho h because of the, exactly. I would like to use
all agree
rho t, and I did use rho t. But I showed you rho h because I believe the results observationally from that.
So but far, you agree that the relevant rho t is determined by the strength of the tidal field?
Yeah,
okay.
Sure.
So strength of the tidal field depends on the...
No, you agree. Let Mark finish.
So do you agree that the galactocentric distance should enter in your rho t?
But this is dissolution time, but it's instantaneous, right? So you can still argue at the given moment for a given mass or a given Jacobi density, which corresponds to a given the dissolution timescale, which is then an instantaneous timescale for the cluster with that mass at that time at that position. Mm-hmm. Okay, so this is to show that you can't take into account eccentricities, And also that you can capture in a simple formula, which is the circular orbit formula, which is just u zero times linear scaling with two passengers. This is what overcomes most simulations. It's not, then we're not going to discussion later, like, oh, but it's actually on our absolute squares. You can still use the basic arguments and then make a small correction. Okay, so this, now we go, how valid is this? Well, it looks very similar, but it's only replacing this small index. Okay, chosen along large font, but it's a small index. And then you get, I don't have to say it because we just heard this, you get the scaling of density in the mass function if you split it up in different bins, and the shift with the peak is more or less with that row h that follows from the theory.
Mike, you agree with this?
Yeah, but I also want to say it's also true when you make the same diagram with row t. As I should go back, I showed you a diagram. We did it with row t. I would love to do it with row t. Please measure row t better if you are interested in this subject. We did it with row t. If we hadn't had that discussion yesterday, if people hadn't been trashing tidal radii on Tuesday, I would have given my talk without ever showing a row h. I only would have showed you a row T, you would have accepted it, it would have been great, end of story. The only reason I gave you the row T version of the story is because I heard so much trashing of RTs on Tuesday. So the row H is not an essential part of our story. It's not an essential part, it's a sideline.
Okay, so
he's about to disagree now. Let
him
go.
You need to come and kill me now. So the question is this thing we have taken more or less constant, right? So that's the fraction of escapers per relaxation time scale. So this is the basic thing that Paul and I did, and it was not to prove anybody wrong, it was just to show what does it do, because I was interested in the range. I was not looking at the density, I just wanted to see what happens if you shrink a cluster, but you leave it at the same location in the galaxy, what happens. So this is basically the assumption in many of the analytical models. Actually, there's a few that don't do it, I'll show it later. And the related question is, do clusters that are smaller in radius, so more compact in their half-mass density, but at the same electrocentric position, do they live shorter because they have a short relaxation time? Well, okay, so the related question is, do we need to consider these small values? Is it really sensible to scale down this RH value to a sub 0.1 scale compared to RJ? Or are all clusters basically in a range of a small factor such that RH over RJ is constant is a good approximation? That's another. So I just plugged in some values. The typical global cluster, 2 times 10 to the 5, cannot be more typical. The radius of 5 parsecs at 10 kiloparsecs now has a relaxation time of more or less 3 gigayears, has a Jacobi radius of 100 parsec more or less. So RH over RJ is 0.05. So that's much smaller than your typical King profile allows at this moment. So if you want to know the current mass state of this cluster, you have to investigate if this psi is the invariant of this ratio RH over RJ, or you can still keep this point 2 or 0.4 from the in-home models. Okay, so I want to show this because yesterday Mike showed for the LMC for young clusters some stuff. I'm not sure if this is a convincing argument, but just to show that it's RH over RJ also for young objects, which you can do for these young clusters that have a density profile that kind of continues all the way down, so they don't have this King truncation yet. You can still estimate where the tidal radius is, which is what they did in their 87 paper, by looking at the mean density within the distance to the cluster center. And because these indices have three-dimensional values higher than 3, these things very quickly converge to a finite mass. So that means that the point where you find your tidal and your Jacobi density is not so much dependent on this shape, and it's actually very close to the core radius, just a factor of 2, 3. So in the LMC, we see clusters which are very compact. So the core radius here versus H. So the 10 to the 8 objects are around 2 parsecs, but the younger ones are around 1 parsec. And I don't think that there's any way to show that this is correlated to the position in the galaxy. So if you calculate this for a average LMC cluster, so I take this 2 parsec right here, I put it at the effective range of the LMC, I find that for a mass of 10 to the 5, you also find RJ, or RH of RJ, is around 0.07, so similar to the one before. So again, this is also smaller than what your typical King profile would allow in your embody simulation style. The other thing related to this is for young objects in M51, which is a phase on spiral galaxy, we measure the effected radii of clusters throughout the disk in the same way, similar ways Chris Warner showed yesterday. These are ages between 1 million year and a giga year. And if you plot the measured effective radii as a function of distance, it's about constant. These are not error bars, these are the regions where we contain 67% of the clusters. So basically all, or two-thirds of the clusters are within this strip. Well, the tidal radius, I haven't done the full calculation, what the actual tidal radius is, but it would scale up with r to the two-thirds, more or less, to electrostatic distance to the two-thirds. So I think what this shows is that the cluster initially doesn't really care what its RH is in terms of where it is in the galaxy. It just forms from some cloud. There's some description how you form a cluster that gives it that RH. The question is how it evolves then. So this is more or less this rough, like the shape it would have, this arc of the things. Now, okay, so what we tried is just to see what happens if you put a small cluster in the same position in the galaxy. So two clusters, this is the classical King W5 Roche lobe fitting, as in this is RT and it's also RJ. And this is another cluster, we just divide all the positions by 2 or 2.5. So the RH of RJ is larger than 0.1. Yeah?
You did that while preserving varied equilibrium.
Sure. Yes. Yeah. In Starlet, there's an option scale. Does that? So, and then this RH of RJ is below the limit of what you have with your available King profiles. So this is why we just divide the position. So the point here, I think, is also important to make, there's a gap here, but I'm not claiming here that clusters form with a gap here. So I don't think it really matters for the simulation, because you will see when I run it, this gap is very quickly filled, and you get kind of this spiral shape out. Yeah. So the thing to realize now is that there's two kind of separate timescales going on. There's the internal dynamical timescale, which is determined by the actual value of RH, which controls core collapse. Right? So if I multiply, if I divide this RH by 2, core collapse will speed up by a factor of 3. It's 2 to the 1.5, 2.8, actually. But in the top, I'll show the number of particles within this tidal density, and the difference is remarkably similar. So the evaporation rate is purely set by the outer radius, which is the Jacobian answer. So this shows that you can disconnect the internal dynamics and the massless rate, and they operate on their own time scales. So there we go. The red line is the core radius, so this is a factor too small over there. So you see that the area is filled very quickly, plus we have already core collapse at the time of 30, and the massless rates are nearly identical. It's below percent. And this one still needs to go into core collapse, because it has this factor of 3 longer relaxation times. So it's 96. It's about a factor of 3. So this, I think, convincingly shows that if you shrink this RH before core collapse and after core collapse, it doesn't really matter for the difference in massless rate. It's really set only by the Jacobi density. And because the massless rates are similar, the time-dependent Jacobi density will be the same also. Right, so if you measure from this one, so the problem is I have 4,000 particles. Now if I would do this for 60,000, I could talk much longer in the pre-collapse phase. I now have only 30 seconds, right? So in these 30 seconds, I want to say that the RH is going to be the same. As long as the cluster doesn't collapse, RH is the same. So if you would pick this cluster, you would observe it in pre-collapse, you measure its density, and you say, what is the massless rate? It'll be off by factor of 3. Right?
So, yeah, so you make the point again that the correct rho to use in the evaporation rate is rho j and not rho h.
Yes. But just because the movie is
fun, you all agreed on that already.
Yes, but the last point, you were not paying attention. And you give me the opportunity of another 30 seconds of pre-collapse. In that pre-collapse phase, if you grab RH, you measure it, and you say, this is the density of the cluster, so I multiply it by my favorite rho h over rho j correction factor, you'll be off. Because that the rho j you measure in this pre-collapse phase is independent of what is rho j at that position.
But we knew that already just by staring at that scatter plot. of RH over RJ, that's all over the place.
My Mark is saying is that not only rho J is the right density to use, rho H has nothing to do with the mass loss rate.
When does rho H become comparable? No. I'm looking at the circles and they look about the same after core collapse.
Well, this is the core radius, right? I didn't blow
up. Oh, the red is the core radius.
So after collapse, this thing, so if you would make this even more compact, this thing evolves like an isolation. So the Hadamard radius doesn't do anything until the core collapse. Then you have a heat generation in the core, you have binaries, and then the thing starts to expand in a more or less self-similar way. So the radius...
But most of this is post-core collapse, right?
So what after this expansion rate, if it meets the tidal radius, yeah, it actually evolves very similar to this one.
So, I mean, halfway through this, I mean, do they have nearly the same half-mass radius?
What do you mean with halfway through?
Well, after you've lost, I don't know, half of the mass or a quarter of the mass, is RH roughly the same?
It depends on where you are in the collapse phase. If this one is still in pre-collapse, no.
I'm saying after half the mass has been lost. That's well after core collapse, isn't it?
Yeah, they're nearly the same. Yeah.
But for this one, yes. And if you have a larger mass cluster, which has a much longer collapse time.
I guess, if RJ is the same and RH is the same, then they're basically, from the King point of view, the same. They have this roughly the same concentration.
Yes.
So then the fact the mass loss rate from then on is equal shouldn't be a surprise to anyone here, right?
Yeah, but the point of this, the magic 30 seconds in the beginning, is that they're not the same in
so
RH.
The 30 seconds is the part that really corresponds
to
the data.
Unfortunately, it's 30 seconds because if I try to make a movie of more than 4,000 particles, my RH doesn't like that. So it's illustrated, right? So multiply everything by
all.
Multiply everything, replace millennia by linear, and that's a bit more. So why is that? Very simple, if you look at the velocity distribution of stars, there's a part of the velocity in the tail, which are above the escape velocity of the cluster. This has been shown for an isolated cluster by all these people that I showed in the bottom before. Now, if you put this cluster in a tidal field, this escape fraction gets a bit higher. And if you make the cluster larger, this escape fraction gets even higher, right? Because you push more stars towards that Jacobi radius, so it's easier for a larger fraction of the stars to escape. So this psi is larger. And what we did is say, if we do this integration over the velocity distribution, what is this psi as a function of RH over RJ? And it's more or less constant. So here, they behave like they are isolated. And then it shoots up exponentially. So if you approximate this by some simple double power behavior, it's constant. And here you have an increase scaling roughly as RH over RJ to the 3/2.
And again, the relevant range for current Milky Way global clusters is roughly from 0.01 to 1, that's sort of the region filled by that scan.
Well, I showed the typical 2 times 10 to the 5 cluster that would be actually here.
Right, no, but the spread is huge. It's plus or minus an order of magnitude, right?
Right, this is about an order of magnitude.
Right, so you are really sampling that whole area there where Psi E is varying considerably. I mean, by about an order of magnitude at least.
Right.
Over the relevant range for what's currently seen in Milky Way global clusters.
Exactly. So now if you use this expression for Psi, so we start off with the same formula again, we put in the half mass variation time, but we use this expression for Psi. So here's this RH of RJ to 3/2, because you have half mass density to the half, you also have the exact same term down there, and then this one comes there, and you can safely replace H by J. Right? So. We're back to the beginning. So the results of this exercise is that if you start playing with the half mass radius, you can affect all your core collapse times, right? Because the dynamical evolution will be purely determined by this RA that you put in the beginning. But you get the exact same result as all the simulations that start with their RAs related to RJ. So if you then do the exercise going through the solution time scales, you can do this in a fully corrected way. So I show here angular frequency times the half mass time, where you have lost half of the stars, versus the initial RH over RJ. And this thing is actually flat over a larger range. And the reason is that it spends a long time in this isolated regime, losing almost no stars then going up and spending the second half of his life in, or depending on where you start here, in the Italian regime. So in terms of lifetimes, this thing is very constant compared to this RH of larger. I think the question for the debate here is, if you start here, how long do you stay there? And how long can it be a hold? So can we see clusters here that are still kind of in this regime or not? But the main summary is that in this tidal regime here, so if you start here, but once you arrive here in this regime, the mass concentration instantaneous at a given time, at a given direction and the position are purely determined by these three things which I've said. This one thing, this galaxy graph. Now, and again, this is not new, so this is a thing I noticed in Ivan King's paper in 66, where it shows that within the range of central concentration, so he changes RH over RJ by just changing the C ground or the W naught. The escape rate of stars only depends on the number of stars and the tidal fields in which the cluster finds itself. So there's nothing new here in what we do. So, and he calls it, there's no obvious physical reason for this. It seems to arise from the fortuitous compensation of oppositing effects. So these oppositing effects are the increase of relaxation time, or the shortening of the relaxation time when you shrink a cluster, but the larger tidal field, which makes the tidal field basically weaker. But these things balance out, and this balance is expressed here in this scaling of xi with Rh over Rj to the 3 halves. That's why these opposite effects are of similar magnitude. Okay, so why do we see this? So something I would like to know, because I heard from many people when they saw this figure as well. But if you see that the density, the peak mass scales with density, it basically shows that denser clusters are more massive. And this, at least in the young cluster environment, has been recognized for many observations. I don't know how much this can be related to this, but I just wanted to point it out as kind of seeds for further discussion. So here I show the plot as was shown in the paper on McDonald and Fall. Mass versus density, here you see a line which is constant number of relaxation. You see that clusters kind of follow this line. Just did the same with clusters from M51. They are 10 to 7, 10 to 8 years old. They also, you see that the massive clusters are in the top right of this diagram, the low mass clusters have lower density. So basically a reflection of clusters having more or less constant radius. Nobody seems to understand why clusters form that way, but young objects have a kind of radius distribution where the radius of the individual clusters doesn't seem to correlate much with the mass. Now, if you then calculate from mass and this constant radius density, it will go more or less like this. Now, whether this is related or not, I don't know, but I think it's interesting that we show and see if this is a step further. Just by matter of experiment, I did the Monte Carlo experiment to show if you expect this. So there's nothing to do with observations. I just do this with IDL because I found out the random number generator and I like that. So number of objects per radius, you just generate a distribution which is close to what we observe. Yeah, and then you generate, this is log normal. I know it's wrong, but it's more or less a peak function with a peak around 10 to the 5. And I just generate this independently. Right? So I just then give these arrays indices and I say which RH corresponds to M is uncorrelated. So a constant mass on average, so constant radius on average with mass. So then if you make the mass density plot, it's like this. And if you split this up in three mass functions with different bins, it looks like this. So very similar as what Mike just showed. And then the peak mass scales with density, where density is defined by these ranges, more or less by this rho h to the half. Yeah, I'm not saying this is the explanation, but it's surprisingly close to the dynamical explanation we just heard.
So just to be clear and provocative, you're saying the result that Mike presented has nothing to do with his underlying theory being right.
Those are your words.
But rather with these scalings that all go back to RH being roughly constant for all
clusters. I'm just saying that if this young cluster radius determination is fine, if we did everything correct here, so this is what they start off before they start their dynamical evolution. There's maybe some caveats there because some of these clusters are so young that they have to still lose up to mass like evolution, so T is zero in this talk and the previous talk is actually T is a few hundred million years, right? So stellar evolution has stopped more or less. You're in the battlefield, or there's not a galaxy flying around, but it's evaporation dominated. So maybe these have to expand first, and they have different initial conditions for that particular T is zero, which is a few hundred million years. But maybe what you say is what I try to say. So, okay, just to show this figure again, as we noted already, the turnover mass is more or less constant wherever you look. The M87 is just a nice example because it spans a large range in galactocentric distances.
What are the things at the bottom here? You didn't say what.
Why didn't you publish this thing without the lines?
I know. The lines are the models. We do not want to discuss this because it involves so.
We should just look at the points.
The points, yes. Just look at the points.
The data, the measured turnover mass is a function of lexin. Now, I don't want to go into this orbit thing, so I just want to turn the argument around. If that's the case.
Is that me or there?
That's you, Brad.
Oh, but I got it now, thank you. Come on, just move on. No.
You heard it like five times,
yes. It could be only four today.
So this, I just want to turn the argument around instead of saying what do we have initially, or what do we want to have initially to make this all work, is to say when you observe, take this M87 example, and that looks like. Mike and I already explained this. If you do it in the NDM and you start with some power law, then you can look at different times. Actually, I normalized these times as well as this delta, this exact same thing as Chris did in the morning. And then the plot in the ending log M shows the turnover, and the position of that turnover scales roughly with this delta. And delta is time divided by the solution time, right? Or time and time of field strength. So here are the three favorite ways of defining time of field strength again. But now it's also the parameter of time, because it depends on how long you are in this time of field strength that determines that delta. Yeah? Okay, so if you want to have this MTO more or less constant, there are surprising little variations, there are trends. And if you want it to be some kind of a universal constant, the basic conclusion of the story is that, and I wonder if you would agree with that, is that this has to be constant. Right? So over the lifetime of clusters, of all clusters in the universe, this product has to be constant. So if you ignore where clusters are now, you can just calculate what the average galactic centric position was for a given or what the average angular frequency must have been for all clusters to get this MTO more or less at the same position. Yeah.
Well, of course, the very meaning of RG and omega might have been time dependent in the sense
that sure.
The whole galactic environment would have changed.
Yeah. But I just want to turn the argument around and say, if you see MTO being roughly constant in all galaxies, in all environments, in different galactic positions, this product has to be more or less constant. You can also take that as an input and say this is what it is. I'm not going to say that's true or not true, but I think this is the conclusion of the observations we just saw, and the assumption that we started with the power of minus. So my conclusion is that it's not rho j or rho h, but it's rho j in terms of mass flow rate. In the type of regime, it's especially very important to not use rho h because it has nothing to do with mass flow rate. It's a factor of 10 in R h, where clearly you can have different values, but the R rho j will be the determining factor. And the conclusion of all that is that to evolve the initial power law to the kind of universal M turnover by only two body relaxation, you need to have this this delta thing, so a certain amount of time times a certain type of instance to be more or less constant for all clusters anywhere. And one thing I think just put there for the start of the discussion is that there's a surprising similarity between the initial radii and masses of clusters, or the initial densities and masses of young clusters, and the ones in global clusters. So it could be that RH we see in the orbitals is more a formation issue than a dynamical result.
Well, it could take about half an hour for a general discussion if people still want to. Oh boy.
Come on, hold on. Say something.
You have to go. But why? I mean, I mostly agree with what you say.
So I just want to reemphasize that Mark did an excellent job in making it clear. That's why, as Mark says, we are obsessed with orbits is because of their dependence on RG, which you cannot ignore. So you cannot just say this is the density, I don't care what the RG is, because if the density is not related to the RG, you cannot use it in the Maslow spread. If it's related to some RG, you need to know what that RG is. So it's not like we like to play with orbits, it's just that it's an essential piece of the physics of this. And if you look at M87 and you see that the turnover is the same no matter what the galactocentric distance is, you must say, okay, what, and that universal turnover has been determined by two-body relaxation, then you must ask yourself, what was the orbital distribution that gave that universal rho j so that you get. And one more point is that I agree with Mark and Holger, it's not like we believe that the initial mass function was a log normal. With Mark on this, I don't care what the initial mass function is. Our point is that two-body relaxation cannot convert universally a power law into a log normal everywhere just using two-body relaxation. So at least my point of view, and I think you agree, is that there must be some more, at least one additional process doing part of the job. So here it's not a controversy between what is the IMF. I don't do cluster formation, so I don't have any strong opinion about what the IMF of the cluster system is. Just saying we need one more process, or at least we need additional processes, and Mike says, no, we don't think we need additional processes. We think we can do everything with relaxation. So that's the, I think it's a first time I got the controversy.
Yeah, I was going to say, we interrupted a couple of times to see whether everyone was on the same page and agreeing with what we said. I think everyone pretty much agreed throughout. I don't know.
Well, the only thing where I think I disagree with Mike is that I don't think you can use the measure of half mass densities to say something about how much mass they've lost. Because I think that's really arbitrary. They can have any ratio of RH of RJ, it doesn't really tell you anything. I think there's a disagreement.
What?
Yeah.
It works. I mean,
yeah,
both are the same plots where it works.
Well, Mark showed you that before, CME.
The question is if it's imprinted by formation or.
So is it this?
Is it because the young clusters also have it, so it's just still there?
Yeah.
Or do they move along certain lines so that the distribution kind of stays the same? That's why I hope that's an interesting point. I mean, this is something many people have observed, so it's favored by Zepp et al. Sven Larsson has shown it. People that are able to resolve these radii for young clusters, they show that it's uncoordinated mass. They scatter, which is seen in large scatter. But if you do a fit, the RH to M is always in the index, is very close to zero. So why is it?
I think so. RH tends to change very little in time.
Yeah, I was going to ask, and I think it's the same question. How do clusters evolve in this diagram with time?
Well,
they just go down? Or?
Well, that depends for what phase.
Well, they simply go down because they cannot gain mass. So.
Yeah, but they go down. But do they go straight down?
This way or this way?
But if they are in a steady tidal field, right? And they are initially with a some kind of K protocol, so they're not compared to their Jacobian radius. They're both, their title that's the Jacobian sequence is more or less constant over time, and also the half constants.
Yeah, I think this diagram is not so there's, I'm not saying this has to be true, but so you're making clusters here, and they're going straight down. They're in tidal fields, so they start going down. And so they go across this line, they disappear, they evaporate. They're making more here. You have to come down here, they disappear. You make more, they disappear. You make more, they disappear. What's the problem?
They don't go straight down, and there is no problem here. It's just that you see the same trend in mass versus GCMF in young clusters.
The details of exactly whether they go straight down, this gets into this issue about whether rho H is correlated with rho K. But there's no question they go down, and there's no question they disappear. So they're appearing here, they cross the line, and disappear. What's the problem?
I don't know if there's any problem.
Wondering how this thing changes over time.
I'm just saying.
It's not the problem. It's the question of which is the correct explanation for your
the implication
correlation of NTO with rho H.
And I just gave you the answer. The thing is, if you make these moves, because apparently they are made, and they disappear over their this line, then there's no conflict, there's no puzzle. This doesn't imply that the other effect doesn't happen or isn't relevant.
But there is already a trend mass
of a half mass length that you claim is the result of dynamical evolution in the young cluster.
But if that comes about when things come across this line, they start disappearing. But the story I told you doesn't say anything about how the clusters are made. There's some information. This is an interesting diagram. And so forth. But I think the reason that you may want to present this is somehow this is an alternative explanation.
Yes.
What I was talking about, that's not true. That's just not at all implied by this. You evidently, if your measurements are correct, the young clusters and they fall in here, that's fine. But there's nothing that's going to stop them from evolving down here and disappearing in the same story I told you, going through this idea. And the density points along this line here will then be given by whatever, that continuity equation here. So we're just talking about a flow in this diagram.
Okay, the question is whether the flow is mainly vertical or whether the flow is mainly along constant radii lines down into the left, right?
Yeah.
So you are basically taking the picture that the flow is vertical. He's saying if the flow were in fact down and to the left along more or less constant RH lines, then there would be another completely different explanation for the correlation that you're
there's not going to happen.
Rho H is going to stay roughly constant during core collapse, and it's going to increase after core collapse.
So I'm
talking about what it really, that's my next question. What does it really do?
I think the point here is that there is in young clusters and even in the Monte Carlo simple example that Mark showed, which is very nice, the trend, the critical smoking gun for Mike's mode is already there without dynamic evolution. Is that what you're trying to say? That is what Mark will say.
Yeah. It's just a little bit suspicious, right? That they are following the same trend. And
from going from the point of stellar evolution, what you always do is you follow the evolution and you draw a curve in an HR diagram, say. So pretend this is an HR diagram and I start off somewhere. What does the evolution curve of cluster look like?
Well, it depends on how compact the cluster is, but
okay.
Before core collapse, it will lose some mass.
Okay.
The radius is more or less constant, as Steve just said.
Okay.
Then it goes more or less like that.
Okay.
Right. And then it expands a bit faster and then it moves like that.
It moves
like that and then it moves a bit more like that.
Okay.
Right.
Right, but so most, if most clusters are still contracting, then most clusters have basically followed paths that are diagonally down to the left in this diagram. At least the ones that are not extreme core collapse.
What do you mean still contractible? I mean, if they're before core collapse,
yes.
Rho H will be roughly constant.
Which means in this diagram they're moving down and to the left along constant RH.
Why did you come down? RH is constant, the mass isn't changing much.
No, L is going down.
Well, but
slowly.
Right. So it's slowly. It's along a constant RH line, more or less, right? Which is about the same slope here, but the constant RH line is a slope of 1 and this is a slope of 2/3. So it's about along that line, so it's like that, before core collapse.
Yeah, there's. I don't see any conflict or any issue with this particular use. I would take exception to the other things said about that. I think that is the distance from this line tells you that the rate of evolution. So, you know, that if the old clusters are here, you know, they are expected to reflect their initial conditions more closely than the ones here anyway. And in fact, what Mark is showing is, yes, when you look at young clusters, they sit where you expect them to become the basis of the old clusters, the slowly evolving old clusters. So that's all fine. And then the story I told you is for this diagram is fine. I don't see any conflict whatsoever. But one other, actually, if you don't mind, I'd like to make another point, and that is that, it would be good if we. So the tidal density is the best density to use. In fact, we sort of rediscovered that as well. And there's a discussion in our paper about the preference for using rho t. It turns out that it shows up not only in the King paper, but some of the relations you showed. But it's also hidden in the Ostracker-Nevin calculations as well, and some of Holder's calculations. And when you go and look carefully at those, they're all consistent with the same story. So I don't think there's any disagreement that the tidal density is the best thing to use. But I think it's not correct then to say that the rho H is completely useless. That would only be true if there were absolutely no correlation whatsoever between those two quantities. An observation there most certainly is between rho H and RT in the clusters where that's well measured. Now, this is a question of rho J versus rho T. But there certainly is a correlation observationally.
Well, we looked at this diagram yesterday. This is the scatter diagram that Holger presented in the discussion.
Okay.
Thank you. Here it is.
Rho H over rho J, that's that. What is that, rho T?
So this is just the ones from the Harris catalog. So the fitted RT and the RH. So what you could argue here is saying, well, there's a limited range of these ratio that you can actually fit, right? Because if you do a fit through profile, you're fitting actually in the inner part. So you're fitting RC over RH, and you get the wings for free. Because there's no law of statistics to constrain on those wings. And the King models have only spread of reckoning too. And this is the observed one, so the spread is a bit larger, but the correlation part with the Gladstonic distance, if there then is kind of increasing, well, if you would present it in RJ, it's decreasing for the majority of them, except for that plume over there. And the question is, of course, is this the one that represents the tidal history of these clusters, or the one on the left?
Yeah, so, see, for example, the one on the left would say that you could use RH as a proxy for RT if you're willing to accept an error of a factor of whatever the spread is. But
if you were to draw a horizontal line on the left there, and you would then label Mike on the left and you on the right, that would kind of capture the whole status of things here.
The implication of that, if RT, we agree that it makes sense, must be the Jacobi radius, so we are seeing the implication of that, where is a cluster at 100 kpc truncated? If RT, you see there are clusters at 100 kpc at more or less, they all more or less have the same half-mass radius slightly increasing with the same distance. So a cluster at 100 kPC has the same RT as a cluster at 1 kPC, if RT is the Jacobi radius. Where is that? What is the tidal field determining the same RT for clusters at such a different delta center distance? So that's my question for you. That's why I think the radial orbits that you picked were very smart idea. It was not confirmed by observations that you could have such a strong radial astronomy, but it was based on physics of the tidal truncation. That's my point. So here, in M87, how do you get this more or less the same?
This is the Milky Way. Could you make a diagram like this for your data set, which is a
The argument you're going to make then is, do I measure RT or do I measure RJ? And
No. But this is hold on. You can have whatever
I can make
RJ
a plot like this.
RJ is a calculated thing.
I can make a plot like this. Yes.
Yeah.
But the point is,
that makes sense, right? So he's looking right through the halo.
So
he has whole column density.
Yes. So the difficulty is that again, it's projected. And not only is it projected, but even if it wasn't projected, my baseline is only like 12 kiloparsecs.
Okay, so forget RJ. And if you did RT, it would presumably look just like
it should look. I mean, it's been a while since I've plotted something like that, but I think it looked consistent with the Milky Way. Nothing that I've plotted doesn't really look consistent with the Milky Way.
I think the question is, does this measure RT? We know that there's a lot of does it mean anything to them? Is
that the right quantity to plot in a mass loss rate? And if it is, you must be willing to say that clusters at 80 kPC from the center of M87 or from Milky Way are experiencing a tidal field with the same strength as a cluster at 1 kPC. Of course, otherwise, mass loss rate.
What these two diagrams are telling you is that the current RJ has not a heck of a lot to do with
what what I'm saying, if you are willing to say that RT is RJ, and that's the real trend for RJ, the left one.
I think it's pretty clear that RT is not RJ.
Instantaneous.
I mean, you believe that there's some sort of memory in this cluster, right? So it evolves wherever it evolves before it ends up somewhere in the halo. And the RT that you measure right now, if there's some sort of the memory of the dynamical history, then I think all the arguments in mind just gave are correct. But I don't know if that's true. I don't want to make a strong statement on that because I haven't figured it out. But I think that's the thing
to look into
because the RT that you measure, there's a lot of observational uncertainties, there's choice of the model. You're gonna have this more or less, you're gonna have this scatter always. There's no way you get points there, there's no way you get points there because the king model just doesn't allow you. So how much is that affected by that? That's something that I think somebody needs to look into. So
is it fair to say that the question or a question is why is RK not RJ?
He's so badly determined, it's so model dependent.
Yeah,
I think we all agree on
this. This is the king fit RT.
Oh, yes. So that's not something.
Okay, doesn't have anything to do with anything.
I wasn't sure about this. When you say the RJ there, of course, the relevant RJ to the story is not the current Jacobi radius, it's the Jacobi radius at the closest approach.
Right.
And is that what that RJ is?
No. Is it just the position in the galaxy and the mass? That's what
it's not clear that that's any more relevant than, to me, because if you were going to make that relevant, you'd have to do it in terms of the strongest tidal field that the cluster
right.
ever
found. Yes.
And so, you know.
I asked Volker, maybe you can look into what kind of parameters of the orbits do you need to make these similar?
Yeah, it's not clear what role this right-hand version plays in its current form to this discussion, because the current position of the clusters spend most of their time way up far away from the center of the galaxy where the tidal field is weakest. And that's where you can see the cluster there, and so you say, I think you know the mass distribution of the galaxy.
Well, it's
so
not different because the potential is not Kepler. We actually plotted some eccentric orbit time spent on as a function of radius, and it's surprisingly it's not really too long in the epicenter and too short in the distance because it's not Kepler. It's quite similar. I just wanted to point out.
But then you're basically back to your constant theory of galactic center, right? Because if your RH or RT is more or less constant, you need to have the same theory of galactic passage to get.
So essentially, to get rid of a radial gradient, you need to have this curve to be flattened. How do you do that? You say that clusters at 100 kdc have a percentile at 1 kdc.
Right.
And
you have to lift the thing on the right up.
Well, there,
Can I just say something totally different than, I guess, the kinds of things that people have been saying so far to explain this? This might be nonsense, but if you're talking about something like M87, which has had all kinds of, you know, it's a CD galaxy, so presumably things are constantly falling into it, I would think that the vast majority of globular clusters in its halo came from other halos,
right,
subhalos that quickly got disrupted.
When?
And so presumably, did you ask when?
Yes, exactly. It's not.
That's
like
a good question. I haven't done that calculation, but I would assume in a, you know, maybe this applies less to other galaxies, but in a big CD galaxy like M87, you know, that's part of a, you know, the center of a big cluster, I would guess that you have like, you know, 10 or 100 to 1, you know, mergers going on all the time. Probably you've had a bunch of recent ones.
If that were true,
what I was going to propose is simply that I was simply going to say that the tidal radius could reflect, you know, basically reflects the densest point in its history, you know, that it reflects the strongest tidal field this thing has experienced in its history. You know, and if it was in a much denser, smaller halo, which was subsequently disrupted and just kind of deposited, you know, that would also, you were talking about, or Romanowski was talking about, you know, negative K4s, which maybe could be evidence that these things were sort of produced in tidal streams,
right,
disruption of a satellite as opposed to following the orbital distribution of the dark matter. You know, if that's true, then, you know, could the lack of radial dependence simply be because these things came from denser halos?
So, the question with that is, if how long does it keep that matter? So if you have a cluster orbiting in a small galaxy with a strong tidal field, you deposit that galaxy in the halo of 37. Is it possible first to disrupt the galaxy in a time short enough that the King profile of the cluster is unchanged? I know I said that very clearly. Because you're going to remove kind of the galaxy, right? If the LMC flies around the galaxy with cluster image, and you come up and say, hey, it's a midway cluster. So you have to get rid of that galaxy first. But then the galaxy has
it's
to be
a good
dense.
Question. One would have to, I don't know.
So you want to get rid of the galaxy without, in time, that you have not altered this truncation position. I don't know. I think this if you put a cluster with a strong tidal field and a weak tidal field, I think very quickly you have
it
this empty spot in the outer part. You saw that in the movie.
But your movies were kind of misleading because with low ends, you get this very quick
crack.
The relaxation time is so short.
Yeah.
So to take Lauren's idea a bit further, if you just forget completely about the current state of that galaxy, and you simply think of the evolution of a cluster that goes through a strongly time-varying tidal field, and you make it extremely spiky. You could do that, of course, with highly eccentric orbits, but forget about highly eccentric orbits and fixed potential. Think of, you know, massive perturbations that happen at more or less random times. And so you imagine this cluster sitting in a tidal field that's occasionally, you know, suddenly goes way deep into the cluster and then disappears. And it does this in a very erratic way. Okay, that's the kind of cartoon picture that Lauren had in mind. Thinking, going in the direction of what Mike was saying here, would that not in fact go in the direction of making the overall average n dots in fact more sensitive to rho h? Because you're effectively sampling deeper into the cluster on average over the long time history.
But this is like a shock argument, right? So that's a different scaling with density.
No, I'm not even thinking about shocking necessarily. Simply having that, think of that tidal Jacobi radius being a strong function of time, and occasionally plunging fairly deep into the cluster for times that are, of course, short compared to the relaxation time. But whatever mass loss you would get during these spikes, I think would start probing, you know, further inside the cluster.
Well, yeah. Has anybody thought about that?
As opposed to, it's not clear to me that how you build the whole global cluster system like in ML7 doing that too.
Well, that's going back to the what's the correct history of a galaxy like ML7.
I don't think there is, at least server say, there is no stronger evidence of recent major mergers in ML7. So you can say
what kind of galaxy is ML7?
A central dominant galaxy.
So there, is there any observational evidence?
Isn't that the prototype galaxy that would have had a lot of recent dominance?
Maybe it's not even major mergers.
Scenario of mergers that are involved all the time. One empirical fact about the fundamental plane of early type galaxies shows that out to Z around 1, everything is consistent with passing evolution.
Out to what?
Z around unity.
Out to redshift of order unity?
What do you mean by everything?
The fundamental plane.
Oh, the fundamental plane. Okay, but CD galaxies don't fall on the fundamental plane, I don't think. That's not important.
87.
Does M87 fall on the fundamental
plane? From the bright end down to the low luminosity end. It's a puzzle. I don't want to say that I have an explanation for that, but talking about all these mergers stirring up all these galaxies in the last 10 billion years, it's not so obvious to me in terms of some basic empirical constraints.
Is that consistent with the naive estimate of the merger rate just from the counting galaxies and the
recognized as a puzzle for the subject. I don't want to say that I have an explanation. I don't know.
But for this type of thing, do you need major mergers? I mean, couldn't you have, what matters is the potential that the globular cluster is experiencing as a function of time. So if it's just kind of moving around from clump to clump, you know.
So let's say that you want to explain a turnover at 80 kbc from the center of M87 as being determined not by the tidal field of M87 now at
right.
80 kbc. So you need the global cluster system, the population of clusters at 80 kbc, something like this, from M87 now to have evolved a large fraction of an apple time in an environment.
Yeah, you need that to be constant.
You need that. So you need to say all the clusters that I'm observing now in M87, no matter where they are, they evolved in a small clump at the center of a very compact galaxy. They reached the right turnover, and then they were deposited in M87 at the right place.
That doesn't sound crazy. I mean, it doesn't.
There's no model doing that. So you're saying that some clusters have been deposited now on M87 because they need one apple time, unless they were living in a very compact, in a very strong tidal field. So if they live at three, let's say, four in a tidal field comparable to the one of the Milky Way at 4 kbc, which is already quite extreme.
Okay, maybe that is.
You need one apple time. Yes, you need one apple time to get the right turnover. So either you do it quite rapidly and you put all the clusters in the right place, and this idea that you have a strong two galaxies with a strong radial gradient, you mix them and they have no gradient, it's not necessarily right at 100 degrees. It's not that you erase memory of a radial gradient. It's been shown in number simulation. That's not true. So I'm not saying it's impossible. It's possible, but it seems to require some fine tuning. And it would be nice to see beyond just. I'm saying it's possible, but it should be done. Otherwise, I have heard this suggestion for many years, but no one has actually done it. But
Mike,
on this point here, actually, I thought about this before, and there's an interesting connection. One of the sort of first things people notice about the globular cluster and the luminosity function is that it's very similar from one galaxy to another, and that the peak had a very small variation from one galaxy to another. So the question is, how did that happen? And I think I know the answer to that. So galaxies are built up over time by merging, and the galaxy that's a big galaxy today consisted of a bunch of small galaxies in the past, but that merging must have taken place somewhere along the fundamental plane, along the Faber-Jackson-Tully-Fisher type sequence, because if it didn't, then those wouldn't be sequences at all. They would just be a big scatter diagram. So, and the fact that it seemed to be roughly constant with redshift reinforces that. So the evolution of one galaxy to the next is somewhere within that plane to a first approximation. And the fact is that the evaporation rate of the star clusters depends on their own internal tidal density, which is proportional to the density of the galaxy they're in. And so then the question is, how does the density vary along this Faber-Jackson-Tully-Fisher relation? Because if it varied a lot, then it would be a puzzle why the peak of the mass function was the same from one galaxy to another. But if you do the, if you just go through the calculation, and this is something that goes back to one of these ancient papers we did, then you find that the people who look at these Tully-Fisher and Faber-Jackson relations, there's a little debate going on as to exactly what the relation is. In luminosity, Faber-Jackson is the internal velocity dispersion going on at the 1/4 power of the luminosity. And that is different in different bands, but if that were also true of mass, if the velocity dispersion with mass is the 1/4 power of the mass, then you can use the variable and calculate how the density of galaxies goes as a function of their mass. And it's an incredibly weak function. In fact, if that relationship were velocity dispersion like m to the 1/3 power, there would be actually all galaxies would have the same density on average. And then all cluster systems would have the same internal density, and the peak of the mass function would always be the same mass. And then you'd understand. So I think there's an interesting connection with this. I mean, this is related to this other suggestion that basically the peak of the mass function of star or globular clusters should be related to the square root of the density of the parent galaxy. And that is a very, very, very slow function of the parent galaxy mass just because of the particular index that the Faber-Jackson-Tully-Fisher relation has. So there's an explanation for you for why the peak of the mass function, you know, related to this issue here, why the peak of the mass function of star clusters is actually almost invariant, almost universal. And in fact, you can, Dean McLaughlin and Andre Jordan even look for deviations from this. You can ask for galaxies that are unusually high density or low density for their mass to see whether they have a slightly different peak mass function in the right direction. And in fact, they do. They actually find that this little relationship works out quite well. So that's another
correctly, you're just basically everything you said could have just been summarized in the sentence, all galaxies have roughly the same tidal fields. Or am I wrong?
They have the same tidal field at their sort of median radius, yes.
Right, so then the question goes away in the first place. Like, you don't even need to know anything about fundamental plane or Faber-Jackson.
No, it's the fundamental plane that tells you that they have the same density. That's where you get the
number. I mean, people would always
actually, Moulin and Weinberg showed that they don't really have the same density. The Moulin and Weinberg, in a nice theory of 1999, they relied on this dependence that Mike is saying is weak, of the strength of the tidal field. It's not so weak because they were saying clusters with in galaxies with different, there is a difference in the strength of the tidal field, and this that we are claiming can explain, doesn't mean that that's the total explanation, the dependence of the specific frequency on the globular cluster systems in the dependence on the luminosity of the galaxy, and in the sense that more, if you start with the same specific frequency, they show that low luminosity galaxy destroy more clusters because their tidal field is a bit stronger than it is for high luminosity.
You're saying the problem is that you don't see this and you're therefore claiming it's not?
Well, no, there is this trend, specific frequency in luminosity, and they show that it could be explained by the dependence of the strength of the tidal field, and they use the fundamental plane mass.
You're then saying the specific frequency measurement is then non-consistent with lack of difference in the turnover, is where you're going with this.
Should be correlated, right?
Well, that's the problem. Why don't you get a correlation between the turnover and the strength and the luminosity?
Well, what you just described sounds like a relatively dependence of the specific frequency or something.
The disruption rate is a function of the luminosity of the gas. Why there is no trend associated to this disruption rate versus luminosity of the host gas? Why there is nothing like mass of the turnover, because it's another issue. Why the trend is weaker in the turnover than it is in the estimated disruption rate is another issue. So, what is the rate in difference in the strength of the tidal field? We looked at that the other day.
Yeah, if the turnover maker does this,
factor flow,
right? So, first it goes up, it decreases in velocity, then it goes down again.
And there's a factor 5 difference in the strength of the tidal field.
Right. But arbitrary shift, so I think nobody has worked out these numbers exactly.
That part. Okay.
So if the moderator just left, I guess this is
So if you're going to dinner and you have a car, or you need